There is no health without mental health. Greetings and welcome to Beyond Madness from me, your host, Professor Christopher Paul Sabo. I'm a psychiatrist and this podcast series is dedicated to the discipline of psychiatry, discussing issues that whilst emanating directly from the discipline have implications for society generally. The series engages thought leaders from within the discipline and beyond to assist in exploring these issues and providing insights into some of the thinking that contributes to the richness of psychiatry. Beyond Madness is proudly brought to you by Adcock Ingram OTC, sponsors of Brave. Have you ever woken up profoundly disturbed by a dream and wondered what it meant? Maybe nothing, but the images linger. Maybe dreams don't mean anything, but if they occur as part of a regular sleep, surely they serve a purpose as part of normal bodily functioning. The body is nothing if not a well-designed machine with purpose. So, what purpose do dreams serve? Today's episode explores the phenomenon of dreams, and I have phrased the title of the episode as a question. Dreams, individual meaning or general purpose, which suggests that it might be one or the other, although personally I'm not convinced that it is the case, namely that dreams either have meaning that require interpretation or that they are meaningless and are simply a phenomenon that serves a purpose like so many other bodily functions. Joining me to discuss this topic and potentially provide an answer to the question, I have the pleasure of welcoming Alison Bentley and Mark Solms. Alison is a medical doctor and has been involved with sleep medicine and sleep research for 30 years. She completed her medical degree at the University of the Witwatersrand, aka WITS, followed by a PhD on restless leg syndrome, also at WITS in 2007. She developed the Dial-A-Bed Sleep Laboratory in the School of Physiology at WITS into one of the leading sleep research entities in South Africa. She has a private practice dedicated to sleep disorders, as well as running sleep studies, both apnea tests and full polysomnograms. She was the founding chairperson of the South African Sleep Society in the late 1990s and is the current chairperson of the South African Society for Sleep and Health. She's also represented Africa on the governing body of the World Association of Sleep Medicine. Mark is a professor and director of neuropsychology at the Neuroscience Institute of the University of Cape Town. He's published 350 articles and 8 books, one of which was The Neuropsychology of Dreams. He's won numerous awards and prizes as he's an honorary fellow of the American College of Psychiatrists. He is an A1 rated researcher as determined by the National Research Foundation, meaning that he is a researcher unequivocally recognized by his peers as a leading international scholar in his field, both for the high quality and impact of recent research outputs. Alison and Mark, welcome. And thanks for making the time to join us, and such a privilege to be hosting you for today's episode. I'd considered borrowing from Shakespeare's Hamlet, that was my matrix at work, to title the episode To Sleep, Perchance to Dream. But I think Hamlet was contemplating death when he spoke those words, so not quite the context of today's conversation. So, I mean, dreams occur within the context of sleep, notwithstanding the phenomena of daydreaming, which I think we're all very familiar with. But it seems appropriate to set the scene with a discussion about sleep. So I'm going to start with Alison. Mm-hmm. And aside from the obvious reality of sleep being something that happens when we are not awake, is there a definition of sleep?
Well, it's hard to define sleep. It really is. Some people have called it reversible coma, you know, like a reversible unconsciousness. Okay. And this kind of sense that almost sleep is a kind of death goes back to, I think it's the ancient Greeks, where the two gods of sleep and death were brothers.
Right.
Okay. So there's this concept that, and there is this, you know, when you fall asleep, you kind of abandon yourself to whatever's going to happen next. There is this, you kind of just have to let go and let it happen, right?
Yes.
So there is a sense that it's an uncomfortable thing to do. Except every single living organism sleeps. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It has a very specific function. It's not just what we do when we're not awake. Wakefulness is poorer if we don't sleep.
Yes.
So sleep is absolutely fundamental to making us have 100% performance when we're awake.
So I like that idea of abandonment, abandoning yourself to this biologically absolutely necessary process
that you have no control over.
Yes, and I think that most people would not necessarily think of themselves as abandoning themselves to a process over which they have no control. It just seems so instinctive and natural to just do that. But when you put it like that, that gives it a slightly different flavor.
Well, certainly the patients who have insomnia are aware of this. I mean, they can't do that. They kind of stumble. They have anxiety about it, about the process.
Yes.
And we get lots of people who come and say, listen, my Fitbit tells me I'm not getting enough deep sleep. How do I get more deep sleep? And I go, you can't control this, right?
Right.
You go to sleep and your brain biologically has the amount of REM sleep it needs, has the amount of deep sleep it needs, constructs the whole sleep. Sleep is not a uniform structure. It's not a single thing.
Yes.
It has different stages.
Yes.
Some of those stages, particularly REM sleep, are very specifically timed.
Right.
And there are a lot of neurochemicals in the brain.
So that's what I wanted to come to, is the fact that it's not a homogenous.
No, it's not.
And so you kind of sleep and you just think, well, that's sleep. But in fact, there's a hell of a lot going on. There's stages, they're timed, they have a duration, there are different things going on. So maybe you can sort of put us in the picture there in terms of what is actually happening when we sleep.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing I think that people don't recognize is there isn't such a thing as an 8 hour solid sleep. Like, nobody sleeps for 8 hours.
Dead.
There are wake-ups. There are natural wakings that occur during sleep. We talk about the fact that there are sleep cycles within a sleep period. So the sleep period would be 8 hours, for example. But the sleep cycle is shorter than that. It's 1.5 to 2 hours, somewhere in that kind of zone. Can be shorter, can be longer. Again, the brain will do this. It's not like something you can plan and you can predict. But the brain, usually when you fall asleep, you would go into what we call non-REM sleep. So to just give people an idea, I mean, REM sleep and non-REM sleep were discovered in the 70s by somebody watching somebody sleep.
That's pretty recent.
Sleep medicine is a very recent thing compared to like cardiology, which has been going on for hundreds of years, you know, study of the heart.
Yes.
Study of sleep really is 50 to 70 years old. I mean, that's really all it is.
And that's incredible because, I mean, that's like 8 hours of your day, potentially on a good day.
Well, it is. It's a significant portion of your life.
Right.
It is, as I said, it is so important that you sleep well, because if you don't sleep well, you don't function well. And that's what we focus on, is daytime functioning.
Right.
That's what we think is the important time. But if you don't get the sleep, then that important time is compromised.
Right.
Every single time. So somebody watching, medical student watching people sleep, that was his project to do, was watch people sleep, notice that there were periods where the eyes were moving rapidly and eyes where they weren't.
Right.
Times where they weren't. So they kind of went, well, that's rapid eye movement sleep, and this is non-rapid eye movement sleep, which
is very... So that's the big broad distinction.
That's the big broad distinction.
Right.
Yeah. Then within non-REM sleep, once we started using the EEG, which is, as most people know, is used for epilepsy. So once we started using the EEG.
Let's just get that clear. What is the EEG?
It measures the brain activity at the very top of the brain. So it doesn't measure down there. It measures what's coming up to the top.
Right.
That's what we can see.
So that's the electroencephalogram.
Yes.
Right.
The electroencephalogram. So once we started using that, we could see that this non-REM sleep was not, again, a homogenous thing. Different types of waves that we can see, very rapid, fast waves, very big, slow waves. But it also seemed to have a pattern to it.
Right.
And within each sleep cycle, then you have a pattern where you go through most of those stages of sleep, in a normal sleep, go through most of those stages of sleep, of the non-REM stages, and then 70 to 120 minutes, I mean, it's very vague, you'll usually have a period of REM sleep.
Right.
And after that REM sleep, a brief awakening. Okay. Now the philosophy is that brief awakening is a survival thing. You wake up, you scan the environment. Is everything okay? You can go back to sleep again.
So actual awakenings during sleep doesn't mean you're having a bad sleep. It actually is part of the process.
It's part of the process, but if you're a good sleeper, you don't ever remember them.
Okay.
So you can see them on the EEG. You can say, aha, they've woken up, right?
Yes.
It could be 5 seconds. But that wake up and that scan is the reason why, if you sleep in a strange environment, you wake up a couple of times a night, which is maybe not normal.
Okay.
Because your brain goes, something's different.
Yes.
Okay. Wake, light's different, sound's different,
yes.
Bed's different, pillow's different, noises are different. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
There's a difference. And so it wakes you up and you just turn over and go back to sleep again. And 3 or 4 days later, you sleep through because now it's normal.
Right. So it's very adaptive. It's very adaptive to the environment. Which is very interesting.
Well, that's the thing. Sleep isn't this homogenous thing that just happens. It can adapt. It can change. It changes if you have a very tough day. So if you have, particularly if you exercise a lot.
Right.
You're likely to have more slow wave sleep that night than you would have on a night that you didn't exercise.
So now this issue of slow wave sleep, because that's kind of occurring in what stage? Because there's various
stages.
That's the
non-REM. Stages. Yeah, so within non-REM. Non-REM, there's stage one, stage two, and stage N3. So N1, right. N2, N3. Right. N3 is this deep slow wave sleep.
And this is the one that really is the restorative sleep?
It's physically restorative. I mean, it's not the only function that it has, right. But certainly most of your growth hormone occurs during that stage of sleep.
Okay, so the release of growth hormone.
Yeah, the release of growth hormone, and then all the downstream effects that happen from that, that when we're adults, we don't necessarily grow, but we repair.
I think that's very important, the repair.
It's repair. It's physical repair. So that's why if you increase the amount of exercise, you increase the amount of slow wave sleep.
Because you need to repair
more. You need
more
repair, yes.
Got it.
You need more repair.
Okay.
So that's slow wave sleep. And I mean, lots of things happen during slow wave sleep. So that's not the only thing,
yes.
You know. And people have tried to kind of go, well, REM sleep is this and slow wave sleep is that. And then somebody comes up and goes, oh, no, you can do that and that as well. It may be not as good, but you can do it there.
Okay.
Or it might be different.
So it's not so absolute.
It's not absolute at all. It's not absolute. So, I mean, I'm sure Mark will tell us.
Yes, now Mark is going to tell us.
You can have dreams in slow wave sleep as well.
Right.
And dreams in REM sleep, but they're different.
Right.
Memory is formed in REM sleep and in slow wave sleep, just different types of memories.
So that's the other issue that I wanted to mention. So there's memory consolidation. Which is a function of sleep.
There was a study in 1928.
It's 1928,
It's the funniest study. So it used two people.
Okay.
Two people.
Well, N equals two, yes.
And they taught them something, and then on two separate days. And on the one day, they didn't let them sleep, and they tested them an hour later. And on the second day, they let them nap for half an hour. And they remembered more after that half an hour nap than they remembered with not napping.
So what was the conclusion?
So sleep is important for memory, consolidate. For right. If you want to, so there's a working memory that we have like just in our head all the time. But if you want to put something into your memory and be able to recall it at a second date,
right.
You need to consolidate it. And that consolidation happens during sleep.
So instead of studying when I'm sleeping, I'm actually doing something. Having studied. Having studied.
Yes.
Caveat.
Yes, having studied. So yes, I mean, if students say to me, like, how should we study? I go, you should study and nap and study and nap and study and nap.
Okay.
But there's like 8 hours of studying and then sleeping might not be as effective as having a nap after a smaller period so that you have time to consolidate. I don't know. I don't know that the work's been done.
No, but it's interesting
angle.
In the sense that there could be an actual scientific basis for napping after study.
Mm,
And not to study for extended periods necessarily without that break that might help to consolidate. Well, I think students out there listening to this will be thinking differently about, I think I need that nap now.
It's like working and filing.
Okay? Yeah. Okay.
And then working and filing.
Okay, but I think that's a very good analogy,
actually.
And I'm not sure that there is enough. I've never heard, to be honest with you, I haven't really thought about it that way because I don't think I've really read about it that way. So I think that for me, this is kind of like a novel concept and I don't know how novel it is.
Well, 1928, it's not novel.
Okay. No, not novel in that sense. But for example, I don't think you have people actively promoting the idea that, you know, if you've studied for a period of time and you feel a little bit drowsy and you want to have a snooze, it's not a bad thing.
No.
Because in fact, what you may be doing is actually augmenting the studying process by having memory consolidation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that is really interesting. I just wanted to come back to the REM, non-REM. Mm-hmm. I think what's important is that REM follows stages 1, 2, and 3.
Mm.
And certainly in psychiatry, what we see in depressed patients is that our REM, because REM occurs at a certain time, and it seems
usually
to occur earlier with depression, and there seems to be more of it, which impacts on the amount of slow wave sleep.
Yes.
So that is where the sort of sleep disturbance comes in. And I wouldn't say it's diagnostic of major depression, but certainly there are sleep changes associated with depression.
Absolutely. And the same kind of thing happens with narcolepsy, for example.
Right.
So narcolepsy, REM sleep happens a lot earlier.
Okay.
But that is that has a neurological basis in the loss of a particular neurotransmitter called orexin.
Right.
And orexin's job is really to maintain wakefulness, but also it seems to have some function in suppressing REM or actually controlling REM sleep.
Okay.
So if you don't have it, then you have an imbalance in REM sleep. I mean, there's no question REM sleep is the most interesting sleep.
So this is the one that I wanted to come to because we're kind of zooming in because we're going to bring Mark in shortly to talk about aspects of REM, which is obviously It's an aroused state similar to wakefulness.
Well, the EEG, so it used to be called paradoxical sleep.
Okay.
Because the paradox was if you do the EEG during REM sleep, it's very similar to wakefulness.
Right.
It's not this deep, like these big waves that occur in slow wave sleep.
Okay.
It's this random, fast activity. Yes, there are some specific waves that you can see in REM sleep that you don't see in wakefulness. But, you know, meh.
Yes.
Meh. If you kind of look at it, it's pretty similar. But REM sleep also has a number of components which are very well coordinated usually.
Okay.
So it's not just about the EEG. I mean, There's obviously the rapid eye movements. Those are something, right? I'm not sure Mark might know, but I'm not sure what they are. But they're so typical of REM sleep, and they only occur during REM sleep. And you know, having spent many hours watching sleep studies, you know, as they roll across, I always got a thrill when I kind of went there going into REM sleep. I can see it coming. Like,
yeah.
I would see the stage two. It would kind of change, you know, and I'd go there going, and I'd go there. Yay.
Okay.
So it is just such a thing, these eye movements that come from the pons all the way up, you know, these. So there's eye movements that only happen during REM sleep. Then during REM sleep, obviously dreams are a big part of REM sleep.
So my question
was
flippantly going to be, is that them watching the movie of the dream?
Well, Mark will tell you. I'm sure Mark will tell you about that. I'm very biological, so I kind of look at that. And then the other component of REM sleep is the paralysis that you have. That again, you have muscle relaxation through all the stages of sleep, but only in REM sleep are you paralyzed.
And that's got a very specific function.
Well, you know, biologically, I would say to patients, you need to be grateful that you're paralyzed, right?
Exactly.
Because if you remember the last dream you have, you could have been acting that out. And in fact, there is a sleep disorder called REM behavior disorder.
That's the one.
Which happens usually in older people where the paralysis, so there's degeneration or just, you know, the nucleus that's involved in this paralysis is not functioning well.
Right.
And so the paralysis kind of flicks on and off during REM sleep. And what happens is that patients then act out their dreams, usually with injury. I mean, they usually get injured because of this. Or, you know, I've had patients who've come to me and the wife has said, listen, I woke up with him straddling me, kind of attacking me, like hitting me. And the husband's going, I'm so embarrassed by that because that's not who I am.
Right.
And I kind of say to him, well, what were you doing in the dream? And he goes, somebody was attacking her and I was attacking them.
Right.
So the sense that if you feel like you're acting out your dreams, you shouldn't be able to act out your dreams. I mean, you shouldn't be able to. For me, you know, and Mark can tell me that I'm wrong, but for me, like, REM sleep is this playground for the brain, you know?
Right.
You're completely paralyzed. The brain can do whatever it likes.
Right.
Because nothing can happen. Like, you're safe. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
And then in REM behavior disorder, you're not safe. So people who come and see me with a fractured collarbone, and I go, what happened? And they go, well, I was playing rugby in my dream, but actually playing rugby and tackled the chest of drawers.
So that's kind of an interesting combination of physical realities. You've got this dramatic stuff happening visually and audio as well, no doubt, but you can't do anything with it.
No.
So now, the other thing that occurs during REM is penile tumescence and clitoral tumescence. Mm-hmm. So what is that all about? Because I suddenly thought to myself, well, the male penis is getting erect, but there's myotonia. So you can't act out.
Yeah, but that's the autonomic nervous system, right?
Right.
So that's a different nervous system.
Okay. So that's what I wanted to.
So the physical nervous system, as in the muscle tone, is all about this. It's what we call a somatic nervous system.
Right.
So that's all about motor function, movement, and it's all about sensory.
Right.
Okay. And you can, at a very central level, essentially interfere with any output from the motor system. There's very little input from the sensory system as well. Okay, except for the sensory system involved in hearing and sight and that kind of thing. So that can still work.
Right.
As can the sympathetic nervous system, so the fright and flight system, and the vagus nerve, which is about the autonomic nervous system, which is about the parasympathetic nervous system. Kind of, we call it rest and digest, that kind of thing. And so penile tumescence and that kind of thing is very much controlled by the sympathetic, parasympathetic nervous system. So that can still carry on. That's not stopped, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So that's not paralyzed.
But it occurs specifically during REM.
It does occur during REM, and I'm not sure exactly why.
Okay, so that was kind
but
of...
But there is... Well, during REM as well, the important thing is that the autonomic nervous system is not well controlled.
Right.
It's not well controlled. So we do have fluctuations in heart rate, for example. So, okay. I mean, things like the Fitbit, okay? So
yes.
If you look at the Fitbit, they use heart rate variability.
Yes.
To, which is how variable is your heart rate.
Which is important.
To define that now you're in REM sleep.
Okay.
Okay, so that's where they – remember, it's just a watch. All it can do is measure heart rate.
But it's telling you.
And so the heart rate variability and whether the pulse rate is increased, whether the pulse rate is decreased, whether it varies a lot, that's what the Fitbit and all of those kind of devices use to define the stages of sleep. They're not completely accurate, but it's a good kind of way to do it. And in REM sleep, it's all over the place. So is body temperature. I mean, if we kind of a bit like a lizard during REM sleep.
Right.
So if you're hot – your body temperature is going to climb, and that's when you're going to wake up. If you're cold, your body temperature is going to drop, and that's when you're going to wake up. And you do that mainly in REM sleep because you can't control it well.
Right.
Does that make sense? So in REM sleep, all of these kind of automatic functions, not great.
So I think that's why it's probably more interesting, because there's stuff going on, a lot of stuff going on. Actually.
Well, there is a lot of stuff going on. And for example, in cardiology, so if we look at heart function, there are a lot of cardiologists who believe, and certainly the sleep world believes, that myocardial infarcts are having heart attacks, much more likely to happen in REM sleep. Because of this instability of the whole system,
okay.
Because your breathing is unstable, because if you have sleep apnea, it's always going to be worse during REM.
People are going to be frightened to go into REM now after this. They're going to be having nightmares, never mind dreams.
They can't stop it. They can't stop it, right? But it's an essential time. It's an essential time for the brain. And so very, very kind of crudely, we would kind of go, slow wave sleep is really about physical restoration.
Right.
REM sleep, brain restoration. Like that's where the brain does its thing.
So that brings me, and Mark's going to come in shortly, to this whole issue of dreaming.
Mm.
So from a physiological point of view, so what's the purpose? What's the function? Because there are some people who would say it's just kind of garbage disposal.
Mm.
You're just kind of filtering out the stuff that you don't need while you're busy consolidating the stuff that you do.
Mm.
Then you have Freud and Jung who would say, no, this is more interpretive.
Mm.
And obviously we're going to get into that.
Mm.
So just what would you say?
Yeah, so I try to avoid this conversation all the
time. Okay, all right. Well, that's why we have Mark here.
That's why we are going to go to Mark quickly.
We are going to.
But for me, it's really so I've been tackled on it a number of times about dreams. And I certainly think that dreams have a function of the filtering, of
right.
the memory consolidation, in the fact that you have to open memories to know where to put new memories. Like there's a filing and a folder kind of function. And you can't just slot memories in if you don't know what's there. So there is a kind of breaking open of that. There's often a very randomness to memories.
Yes.
But for me personally,
yes.
and for many people that I've spoken to, I don't remember a single dream.
Okay.
Like I don't, so people go to you, no, but if they tackle me and they kind of go, no, it's your subconscious speaking to your conscious, then I kind of go, well, in me, doing a very bad job.
Your subconscious is fast
really,
asleep.
Really
your subconscious is fast asleep and not doing anything.
But I'm not, honestly, if I think about the dreams, so I used to have very bad dreams when I was a kid. I remember those.
Right.
Absolutely remember them. But as an adult, I don't, I honestly can tell you like 2 months ago I had a dream.
Okay.
Like that's literally what it is. Most nights, last night, did not have a dream at all. Obviously I dreamt, obviously, because that's part of dream, that's part of REM sleep.
Yes.
But you don't remember your dreams unless you wake up in them.
Okay.
So I just hope that my consciousness and my subconscious are having a thing, having a tea party.
Quietly behind the scenes.
Without me knowing about
behind
it.
Behind the scenes.
Because if that's what the function is and I'm not aware of it, I don't know. Do you know what I mean? But
okay.
I also don't think dreams are one thing.
Yeah.
Like I don't think they're all prophetic or they're all this or they're all that.
I'm glad you mentioned prophetic.
Different types of dreams.
I'm going to give you an account later on, but first I want to bring in Mark,
yes,
who's been patient.
This is his point.
No, this is so. Mark, I have to tell you, I watched your lecture on YouTube entitled "The Dreaming Brain" that you gave to the Royal Institution in May 2021. I found it fascinating, and you really set about explaining your theory about dreams based on research you had conducted, and I'd like you to, if you can, just walk us through what your theory is, what you did, what you found, and ultimately what you concluded. So I know that's a hell of a lot, but I'm going to hand over to you, and hear what you have to say.
Thanks. Well, we spend 20% of our sleeping hours, although, as Alison just said, we don't remember it. We spend a lot of time dreaming. So, you know, this is a very substantial part of what the brain does. And when I first started studying the topic, which was in the 1980s, it was, sort of remarkably neglected aspect of our cognition. We knew a hell of a lot about the brain mechanisms of language and perception and memory and whatnot, but we knew very little about the brain mechanisms of dreaming. So what I did was the standard thing that one does when you wanting to get started in mapping out the neural correlates of a mental function. You have a look at what happens to that function with damage to different parts of the brain.
Right.
It's called the clinico-anatomical method. Mm-hmm. And, remarkably, as late as the 80s, this method had never been applied to dreaming. So that, I was interested in a kind of fishing expedition way, just having a look at what happens if there's damage to the left versus the right side of the brain, the frontal lobes versus the parietal lobes versus the temporal lobes, and so on.
Yes.
And my predictions, such as they were kind of the obvious ones. Like, for example, if you have a left perisylvian stroke and you're aphasic, then you won't have language in your dreams. And if you have bilateral posterior cerebral artery stroke and you are cortically blind, then you won't see anything in your dreams.
So just to jump in there, Mark, so these are obviously correlates within the brain of specific functions. So when you ablate those areas, you lose those functions in real time. But in fact, what your theory was, you won't have them in your dreams either.
Yeah.
Right.
And, that's not a surprising theory. It's kind of what you would expect. There was nothing particularly interesting about the hypotheses that I started with. What was much more interesting was the surprising findings that emanated from that study.
Right.
I studied a large number of patients, 367, I think it was, with focal brain lesions. And it took a while to accumulate that number of patients. And these are the things that we found. First of all, that damage to the pontine, Alison mentioned earlier that there's a part of the brain stem from which the PGO waves come, but that's also the part of the brain that drives the whole sleep process.
Right.
And patients with damage to the part of the brain stem that generates REM sleep, the mesopontine tegmentum, they carried on dreaming, even though they no longer had REM sleep.
Huh.
That was a super big surprise. When I went through the literature, I discovered to my amazement that nobody had ever, we had established in animal studies and in human cases that damage to that region leads to loss of REM sleep, but nobody had bothered to study, what the effect is on dreams. And so it was a complete shock to learn in the late 20th century, a good 50 years after REM sleep had been discovered, that it's correlated with dreaming, that nobody had ever established that loss of REM sleep due to damage to that part of the brain leads to loss of dreaming.
Right. Carry on.
Yeah. So, and then what I found was conversely, there were areas of the brain which, when damaged, lead to a loss of dreaming. And in those cases, there's preservation of REM.
Sorry, Mark, just to jump in there, what you're saying is that the loss of REM didn't lead to loss of dreaming.
That
you didn't have REM because we've got this exclusive kind of understanding, REM equals dreams. But what your finding showed was that actually not necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, that was what we all assumed.
Right.
The correlation was so strong, being awakened from REM sleep, you have something like a 90% chance of getting a dream report.
Right.
And being awakened from non-REM sleep, it's less than 10% chance of getting a dream report on average. The correlation was well established, and so it was perfectly reasonable to assume that the brain mechanisms of REM sleep, in other words, what generates REM sleep, is what generates dreaming.
Right.
And I didn't expect to find anything other than that, so it was a big surprise to find that damage to the part of the brain that generates REM sleep does not lead to loss of dreaming. and that damage to a quite different part of the brain does lead to a loss of dreaming with preservation of REM sleep. We call that a double dissociation of function. It means these are two separate functions. Dreaming and REM sleep are not the same thing, although they're highly correlated. You know, so that's a sort of fundamental mistake we teach first-year students in statistics. Correlation is not causation. And the areas which lead to loss of dreaming are in fact twofold. The one which is not so surprising is in the parieto-occipital cortex, which is important for visual perception.
Right.
And dreaming is, you know, a visual perceptual phenomenon above all else. These patients lose dreaming with preservation of REM sleep. That was not so theoretically interesting. But what was terribly interesting was that there's another area, which is the white matter at the base of the frontal lobes, the white fibers coursing underneath the lateral ventricles from a different part of the brain stem, an area called the ventral tegmental area. And this circuit is called the mesocortical mesolimbic dopamine circuit.
Okay.
Damage to that circuit bilaterally leads to a cessation of dreaming. And that was there was no obvious association between that part of the brain and the experience of dreams. So that was worthy of further research.
And as a psychiatrist, that kind of gets me interested, because now we're talking psychiatric territory in terms of mesolimbic, for example, and the fact that a lot of psychopathology is thought to emanate from within disturbances in that area. So anyway, I just thought I'd jump in there as a psychiatrist and say, that's interesting. Carry on, Mark, sorry.
I don't want to remind you of the dark days of psychiatry of the last century, but that was precisely the pathway that was severed in a prefrontal leucotomy.
Right.
For the treatment of psychosis.
Right.
So, as ghoulish as the procedure was, it was actually rather successful in reducing positive symptoms of hallucinations and delusions.
Right.
And if you pause for a moment and think about it, it's not surprising, because what are dreams if not hallucinations and
delusions? Well, this is something else that I came across, which is really the kind of link between REM sleep, schizophrenic-like manifestations in terms of dreams. So, I mean, that is interesting, and maybe you want to elaborate a little bit on that as you go along.
Well, a prefrontal leucotomy was performed on thousands of schizophrenic and other psychotic patients in the middle of the 20th century. And I, having observed in my study that patients with lesions there, which are actually quite hard to get a discrete lesions bilaterally in a ventromesial frontal white matter. So I didn't have a large number of them. And I went back to the old literature from the 40s and 50s and found that, in fact, I hadn't discovered anything new, that the psychiatrists who did that op those days in the heyday of psychoanalysis, they were interested in dreams. So they asked their patients about dreams.
Right.
And this was it was observed in large clinical series that the effects of this operation were, first of all, reduction in positive psychotic symptoms.
Right.
Secondly, a loss of motivational initiative, loss of drive. And thirdly, a loss of dreaming.
Interesting.
And in fact, one German psychiatrist named Schindler observed that if the patient after the operation continues to dream, it's a bad prognostic sign.
Right.
And again, for the obvious reason, it shows you're still able to generate hallucinations and delusions if you're still able to generate dreams. But what was really and by the way, it wasn't only so that was my study I published it in the late 1990s. But then subsequently, there were other studies using other methods. So we did single cell recordings in the ventral tegmental area and found that those neurons are firing rapidly with burst, which maximizes the release of the neurotransmitter, burst firing, maximally during REM sleep. And which, let us not forget, is 90% of the time you're dreaming during REM sleep. So even though they're not the same thing, you can operationalize dreaming sleep as REM sleep for the purposes of that sort of study.
Right.
We also found with microdialysis that dopamine is maximally released during REM sleep.
Right.
And also with pharmacological manipulations, you can increase dreaming with dopamine agonists and you can decrease dreaming with dopamine blockers.
So dopamine seems to be a critical neurotransmitter in relation to dreams. Would that
Absolutely.
Be correct?
Yeah. So the critical neurotransmitter for REM generation is acetylcholine.
Right.
And the critical transmitter for dream generation is dopamine.
Okay, that's very important because, I mean, we're disassociating REM and dreams. It's not an absolute relationship. And we're saying that there are different neurotransmitters for either aspect.
There really are. I mean, not only did we show that dopamine blockade leads to suppression of dreaming, but if you give anticholinergics, in other words, if you block acetylcholine, you would expect, if that was what was driving dreams, that you would then have less dreams. But in fact, it's the opposite. You have increased dreaming with anticholinergics. In fact, as you might know, you can dream while you're awake if you take anticholinergics. So it's it's a very strong dissociation. Dreaming is driven by dopamine, very well established by these multiple methods that I've mentioned, and REM is driven by acetylcholine, which raises the question, why do they correlate? You know, why do they occur together?
Yes.
But the most interesting thing is that I mentioned that those leukotomy patients that they reported, those who studied them
Yes.
observed a substantial loss of motivation. And so, you know, what's interesting is that the circuit that drives the dream process is more than anything else. In other words, this mesocortical, mesolimbic dopamine circuit. It's a motivational circuit. Mm-hmm. If you look at the dreaming brain, like, for example, you look at PET imaging of what the brain looks like during REM sleep.
Yes.
It's really very interesting that you have deactivation primarily of frontal cortex.
Right.
There's quite a lot of cortical deactivation, but regionally it's mainly frontal. And you have massive activation of the limbic circuitry almost in general, but in particular of this motivational, this dopamine driving reward-seeking circuit. It's actually called the reward system by many behavioral neuroscientists. So, you know, Norm, if you look at that picture of what's going on, you would think, you know, this person's disinhibited, first of all, because their frontal cortex isn't functioning.
Right.
Which we think has to do with the lack of agency in dreams. You know, Alison mentioned that you can't control sleep. And likewise, apart from a few people who have the lucid dreaming, you know, most of us, we can't control our dreams. They happen to us. You are just a passenger in your dreams. And we think that has to do with the prefrontal deactivation. But if, you know, so you first of all, you don't have that frontal regulation, that executive control of your mental processes. But secondly, you have this massive surge of dopaminergic motivation. So the question is, you know, in waking life, if you had a patient who had no frontal cortical control and this massive drive of dopamine, you would expect them to be doing all sorts of things.
Exactly.
And as Alison said, in REM behavior disorder, you see that we do all sorts of things, and all sorts of instinctual things. As a matter of fact, the violent behavior which is the most common, aggressive behavior is the most common of what you see in REM behavior disorder in human beings. In other animals, you see all sorts of instinctual behaviors.
Animals dream?
Mm-hmm. Well, we can never know for sure, but the evidence is pretty strong that they do. Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, so that comes back to the point that I've made earlier about the myotonia. I mean, the myotonia is actually a critical component of that time. Otherwise, there would be absolute chaos in every bedroom,
mm-hmm.
every night.
Yeah, yeah. So my own, you asked me what my own theory is.
Yes.
It's not a big theory. It's a little theory. It's kind of in the sense that it's sort of obvious in that it flows directly from the things that I've just told you.
Yes.
My claim is that because we have this motivational surge while we're asleep, and it is incompatible with the state of sleep to be doing whatever it is that the motivation is impelling you to do. Instead, you dream. In other words, dreaming is a kind of imaginary doing stuff rather than really doing stuff. So it's my claim was that dreaming has some sort of sleep protective function, that you, by acting out your motivational urges in the virtual reality of the dream, you're kind of diverting that motivational impulse into this imaginary space rather than actually doing something in the real world. And we've just done a pilot study to test that hypothesis.
Right.
We're now doing a bigger study in Berlin at the Charité Hospital. But the pilot study we did here in Cape Town at Groote Schuur, and we just compared a small number of non-dreaming patients with dreaming patients, but these were not ones with damage to that dopamine pathway.
Okay.
These were patients with damage to the occipitoparietal cortex. So remember I said that perceptual cortex at the back,
yes,
visual perceptual cortex, if you have damage there, you also have loss of dreaming. So we in those patients, the dopamine circuit is still intact. So the prediction was the non-dreamers should have worse sleep than the dreamers if dreaming has some sort of sleep protective function.
And did you find that?
We found it very strongly, although, of course, it's small numbers, and the bigger study is still busy running, so we can't say anything conclusive yet. But the differences between the dreamers and non-dreamers were enormous.
Well, I think the reason I'm jumping on that is because I came across, and for the life of me, I couldn't find the reference after I'd extracted the information, that actually dreamers seem to have much greater sleep, fewer awakenings, fewer arousals, fewer micro arousals than non-dreamers. So in fact, from a functional point of view, dreaming is actually very good.
Yeah, that's if it, as Alison told us earlier, how very important sleep is for our health. You know, if dreaming has a sleep protective function, then it's a jolly good thing. And the difference is just, you mentioned those variables a minute ago, but I mean, the numbers, the differences in micro arousals, and awakenings between dreamers and non-dreamers are in the order of 3 to 4 times.
Okay.
You know, you have 3 to 4 times more arousals, micro arousals, and awakenings if you don't dream. And you spend 25% less of your sleeping hours, of your nighttime hours sleeping. In other words, there's a 25% loss of total sleep time if you don't dream.
So we're looking at dreams in a very kind of physiological way. It's a very protective at a bodily level. So, Mark, I just have to, because I think people are going to be curious about dream analysis, dream interpretation, Freud, Jung, etc. Where do you see that fitting in? Because the understanding, and increasingly, you know, in terms of our discussion, is that, well, you know, dreams have a very specific purpose at a physiological level. But what about all the other stuff? Because I think that is what seems to fascinate people increasingly, or always has, I think. It's not just increasingly, I think it's always been. So what would your thoughts be on that?
Well, since ancient times, I mean, let's go back before Freud and Jung.
Yes.
Since ancient times, in just about every culture, people have believed that dreams have some kind of meaning.
Yes.
So you know, it's interesting that for thousands of years, all over the planet, people have believed that. And, you know, they're different, depending on the culture, the meaning that they ascribe to dreams is different. The Freudian view was, as was alluded to earlier about conscious and unconscious and all of that, you know, was that there's some sort of release of from inhibition of what are normally unconscious motivational drives, and that the dream gives expression to those. You know, I wouldn't have given credence to that view, or for that matter, to the pre-scientific views, and you still hear them today. You know, I speak to popular audiences,
yes,
non-scientific audiences, and always there's somebody in the audience who says, "I have my dreams foretell the future." You know, my dreams have a. You mentioned prophecy earlier.
Yes,
you know, I wouldn't have given any credence to that either, and in fact, I think that it's very unlikely that they do. But I think that there's, you can see from a scientific point of view where this all comes from when you recognize that dreaming is driven by that dopamine system. It is the functional name for that system is the seeking system.
Okay.
It is a kind of forward-looking, foraging, exploratory sort of drive that is mediated by that circuit. So it has something to do with sort of anticipation or prediction or looking ahead, trying to achieve something. So I think that from a scientific point of view, that's probably what people are intuiting when they feel the dream has something to do with the future. And when the Freudians were saying it has something to do with giving expression to wishes, you know, to deep, dark wishes, it's something about, you know, the future.
So can I ask you, because I'm going to tell you a short story about a predictive dream that I had, and it stayed with me. So I had a patient who I was very closely connected to. They were no longer under my care, but we'd formed a very strong, they had formed a very strong bond with me. Anyway, the patient moved on, and some time later, I encountered a colleague, and I said to them, so let me just say, I woke up one morning profoundly disturbed by a dream that I'd had. And the dream that I'd had was of this patient having committed suicide and was found hanging in the linen room of an institution. And I woke up profoundly disturbed, and I thought, it's just a dream. Forget about it. But I was profoundly troubled by it. Sometime later, I encountered a colleague, and by chance, I said, do you know what happened to so-and-so? And they said, oh, hadn't you heard? I said, I've got no knowledge for some time. And they said, well, family went to visit. They had been admitted, couldn't be found, searched for, and found, having hung themselves in the linen room of the institution. And I said, come on. I said, how is this possible? I said, I actually dreamt it. I said, when did this happen? And he said, well, at about the time that I'd actually had the dream. And I said, come on, how do you explain that? It's not possible that I could have had this dream. And so for me, the experience of having had a dream that reflected reality without my knowing the reality stuck with me. And so I've always been a little bit wary of dreams, and I sure as hell don't like those kind of dreams. But I've had one such experience, and I'm sure that doesn't necessarily equate into a theory. But how would one explain that, Mark?
Well, look, I think what I need to say first of all is that we scientists are always, you know, oh, well, you can explain it like this. You know, I think we have to have a little bit of humility and remember that there are, you know, more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our philosophies. We don't understand everything. And so I'm willing to have an open mind about these sort of things. But I will tell you what I think we can say scientifically.
Yes.
And it's sort of deflationary, I'm afraid. the first thing is, you know, Alison mentioned the importance of sleep, right, and REM sleep in a specific way for memory consolidation.
Right.
So, you know, what is memory? Memories are about the past, but they are for the future. Memories are for predicting, you know, on the basis of what happened in the past, I predict that, you know, this is more likely than that to happen in the future. That's the whole purpose of learning.
Yes.
So memory is a predictive function. It serves prediction. So the memory consolidation processes that are going on during sleep, and we don't yet know what part is played in dreaming itself in that process, because remember, you know, the sleep mechanisms and the dream mechanisms are not the same thing.
Correct.
But yeah, we do know that memory consolidation is going on. So something to do with prediction is going on, you know, and that's a very small claim. You know, it links to your experience in that it's got something to do with the future, as I was saying earlier, something to do with predicting. Now, the chances of your being able to, as a good psychiatrist, to be able to predict that there's a risk here with this patient, you know, there's a suicide risk.
Yes.
Even if you're not explicitly thinking it, it brings you into the ballpark of what happened. And that doesn't explain how you knew these details of when it would happen and
yes.
and where it would happen. And that's where I say we have to remember, you know, that there's that there's some things we don't understand and can't explain.
Well,
but I think in the ball, you're in the ballpark of predicting
right.
on the basis of experience. But I want to add one further thing, which
yes.
is again deflationary, which is that, you know, of course you remember that one dream.
Yes.
Because that one occasion in your entire life, of all the dreams that you had, one coincided with reality.
I hit the spot.
Yeah, statistically, it's probably about as much as you should expect that once out of a billion occasions, you actually get it right by chance.
Mm. Right.
I think that's been my response to people who've come up to me and said, but I had this dream
yes.
that this plane was going to crash and it crashed. And I kind of go, so how many other dreams did you have about planes crashing where it never happened?
Well,
okay, and they always go, they kind of step back and they go, oh, yeah, okay. It's there's a probability that it might happen.
Well, I hear you. And
But it's okay. You can have your dream.
I kind of had to put it out there. Well, because the truth of the matter is there is no definitive explanation.
No.
It's pure chance, pure coincidence. Is there more going on? Is there more to our existence than we understand? But that's a whole different discussion. But I want to change tack just briefly. And I want to talk about nightmares. And I specifically want to talk about that within the context of post-traumatic stress disorder, because obviously those experiences are very real for the patient. They reflect an actual traumatic incident. So there we have a bad dream, which is very, not just symbolic, but actually reflective. And I think for me, that then begs the question, to what extent, you know, as much as we have random sort of imagery in dreams, to what extent actually dreams do concretely reflect reality if one is taking the nightmares in PTSD as an illustration? Mark, what would your thoughts be?
Yep. So first of all, you know, in the past in psychiatry, there have been, I think, excessive claims about, you know, we understand dreams, we can interpret dreams, dreams mean this, dreams mean that.
Right.
But I think that the opposite claim that dreams are utterly meaningless is equally unfounded. It's the answer is somewhere between the two. And I
yes.
think the point that you just made is a very good one, starting with the nightmares of PTSD patients. Clearly, these dreams are not random. You know, clearly these dreams refer to current concerns, to real events that are meaningful in that patient's life.
Right.
Then there's empirical work more broadly than with the PTSD patients, which demonstrates empirically that current concerns are reflected in dreams. You know, so the things that are on your mind that are troubling you, that you're thinking about, that stressing you out, what you're worrying about, those themes are likely to appear in your dreams, and that's demonstrably true. Then there are also all sorts of other bits of evidence. I mean, for one thing, what I've just mentioned, the fact that motivational system, it's the main motivational system of the mammalian brain, you know,
right.
that dopamine system. The fact that is so switched on like a Christmas tree while you're dreaming, you know, suggests, well, perhaps there's some motivational thing, something that matters to the dreamer,
yes.
you know, is driving the dream process. And then there are all sorts of other things. I mean, like, for example, you can predict Rosalind Cartwright showed, you can predict who's going to become depressed after a divorce from looking at whether the affect in their dreams improves over the night or doesn't. If it doesn't improve over the dreams over the night, then that predicts that person's going to become depressed.
So we come to the issue of dreams as prediction.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting in a different way. But I think what's interesting in terms of the nightmares and PTSD is that I came across some cutting-edge research at the moment, and they speak about a precision neuronutrient dopamine agonist, KB200Z. And they've done studies on this substance, which actually eliminates nightmares and can actually lead to the initiation of pleasant dreams. So coming back to this whole issue of how important dopamine is. Mm. So this is not a commercially available product,
mm-mm.
but they're conducting early studies. And, you know, I think that for sufferers of PTSD who have nightmares, it's heartening to understand that there is some kind of work that would eliminate this awful aspect of the illness. So, Mark, that kind of comes to the issue of dopamine and dreams and nightmares. I don't know if you've come across this work or if you've seen the work, but certainly, as I said, it seems quite preliminary, but it looks very promising, actually.
I think what I find always useful for patients who have nightmares is the understanding that the nightmarish part of it, i.e. being stuck and not being able to move, comes from the paralysis. That you have a brain that's going, go, 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 run, 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 and the body's going, meh, love to do that, but, can't move. And so that sense of I can't move, I'm stuck, is a very biological thing.
Right. And that's very scary.
Yeah, it's very scary. But honestly, patients, when they know that, they go, oh, okay. So that's just a thing about how my body is. And I go, yeah, it is. And that takes away a lot of the why can't I do something? Why can't I? Why can't I?
So you're kind of saying just go with the flow.
You can't stop that.
You can't stop it.
It's a good thing that you can't act out that what you're thinking of, because you'd get up and run out the bedroom.
Absolutely. So I think
maybe not so good.
Well, maybe not so good, depending on how you're dressed. So the issue is that I think we're saying it's not one thing or the other. It's not that dreams are all about interpretation or all about physiology. There's probably something somewhere in between. But I think we have a greater understanding of the physiology of dreams and the sort of brain structures and some of the neurochemistry that is associated with dreams, which I think is very important. And also the purpose that dreams serve. If we put the interpretation and the predictive stuff to one side, there's actually an important function that dreams actually serve in normal human physiology. Mark, would you concur? And Alison?
Yes, I would. I think that that's what we can say now. I think there's a hell of a lot more that we will be able to say in the future. This is a developing field. But in other words, I'm saying I don't believe that dreaming has no function. I think we've established, at least in a preliminary way, that it has some sleep protective function. I don't think by any means that's its only function. Dreaming doubtlessly has many other functions that are still to be discovered. But it's not just froth. It's not just nonsense.
You know,
both physiologically and psychologically, the dreams are doing something.
Yeah, I think once you accept, which I think we do accept, that dreams are a physiological process. They're not some spiritual kind of random thinking process. There's no function in the body that's a proper physiological process which is not useful.
Exactly. That was something that I had thought, well, what's the purpose?
Yeah, there must be a purpose. The fact that we don't know the purpose just means we're not clever enough yet to figure that out. That's all.
So I'm thinking of the word which describes the scientific study of dreams, oneirology. I think that's to some extent what we've been talking about today. And I just really want to thank you, Alison, and Mark for joining us and sharing of your time and knowledge. I think it's a fascinating conversation and a fascinating phenomenon. And we don't have answers, but we have some. We don't have the full answer, but we have some answers that give us an understanding of what purpose dreams might serve. So whatever your thoughts on the phenomenon of dreams are, there's a more straightforward view from one of America's greatest short story writers and a personal favorite of mine, Raymond Carver. He said, dreams, you know, are what you wake up from. So remember, there is no health without mental health. I hope today's podcast has been enlightening. I am Professor Christopher Paul Sabo. This is Beyond Madness, in proud association with Adcock Ingram OTC, sponsors of Brave.